Hey, welcome back. This is another edition of my conversation with a good friend, great friend, one of my best friends, Eric Wesley, career Army soldier, retired as a three-star general, now is doing incredible things in the private sector. Eric and I first met in Kuwait in early 2003, and we've been friends ever since. He was a brigade executive officer. We went to war together. His unit, the 2nd Brigade Combat Team, commanded by then-Colonel Dave Perkins, a big tank unit. I went with these guys all the way to Baghdad and came back to see them again, and I was in Fallujah with them, and we saw some incredible things, and he's an incredible human being. Started off as a cadet at West Point, three-star general, retires as with a... I think 4 combat deployments and 2 to Iraq, 2 to Afghanistan, 2 years in the Obama White House on the National Security Staff. Lots of interesting little chapters. So this is part 2 of our conversation. You're in Colorado right now, right?
I am. We retired. We bought a house in Monument, Colorado.
Monument, Colorado. Wow. What then? Now that's a town. Monument. Where is that?
So if you know the 25 corridor between Colorado Springs and Denver, if you just go north of Colorado Springs about 15, 20 minutes, there's a small town called Monument. It has a beautiful view of the Front Range, the Air Force Academy, lovely area.
So when you're in the Army, you are, what rank are you in 1990?
1990, I was a captain. I think I'd been promoted to captain by then. We had... left Germany 2 days before Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, and I went to the advanced course at Fort Knox, Kentucky.
So that's my thing. There's an invasion of Kuwait. They start mobilizing the troops to go over there. Are you part of that? Do you get to be a part of that ever? Do you fight in that war?
This is the great irony. No, I was not part of the 91 Gulf War. And like I said, the reason I was with the 1st Armored Division in Europe, and you may recall that we ultimately deployed the 1st Armored Division to fight in that war from Kuwait into Iraq, or rather from Saudi Arabia into Kuwait and Iraq. And ironically, I just left there to go to my next career course, and that was the captain's career course or advanced course at Fort Knox. And so I and many of my peers ended up watching the playing out of this war with Iraq in 1991.
And how frustrating is that? Or is it frustrating? Or is it a problem? Do you start to worry, look, if this is a big deal, you know, and I'm not in it, that's going to not be good for my military resume. There is competition. If there's a war going on and you're in the military, you kind of want to be in the war. At least a lot of people do. How did you feel during all this?
Yeah, you do. It was a very humbling experience, Greg, I got to tell you. And for those who don't have a lot of experience with military experiences or a military career, it might sound a little macabre for a soldier to say, you know, I missed out on the war. I really want to put that in context. Every one of my peers, as we were in class watching CNN and watching this unfold, we wished we could be a part of it. Why is that? It's not macabre. If you are any professional, any professional career you might identify with, if you're an attorney, you want to be in the courtroom. If you're a doctor, you want to be in the OR. And if you just study surgery, if you just study the law, but you don't have the opportunity to practice it, that can be at times discouraging if you're not part of that. That was a big moment for our Army, and we're all part of a team. If you play football, you don't want to sit on the bench. You want to be on the gridiron. And so, it was difficult and humbling. I'll tell you a little quick story. As we were watching this play out on CNN, and we'd be in class, and our classmates would joke with each other and say, you know, we're going to go to our new unit and end up having to plan the parade. Well, ironically, that's exactly what happened to me, because we left the advanced course. We went to Fort Riley, Kansas. I became a staff officer in the operations office. And the first assignment I got in my new unit after the war was over was to plan the victory parade. So look, it was a bit humbling, frustrating, but you grow through it, right?
So, by the way, it seems incredibly bureaucratized, the military. There are so many, when I was in, there are just so many slots and places to put people. And is that by design? Is it like, okay, look, we're going to be around for a long time between wars. We need a lot of people to fight the war. In the meantime, you know, we got to keep these people on a short leash. We got to keep them around. You can't just activate everybody. So is some of this stuff make work? Just, all right, we need a million guys at any given moment. We don't have all that much to do for a good chunk of them in the meantime. So we got to, you know, invent stuff to do. We got to go to this school. We got to go to, I don't know, that fellowship. We got to be on that staff. Now, all that stuff is, some of those schools have value. But I was always struck by all the places you could go and just kind of hang out and not really have to produce. Yes, you got to like do your job, but you could take long lunch breaks. You could take leave. Do you know what I mean? And forget about all the lunch break stuff that I just mentioned. You got a million guys. You need them for the war. You can't actually, you got to do something with them during peacetime. Is there anything to what I'm saying?
You know, Greg, I love you, but I got to respectfully disagree. If I was a taxpayer listening to your narrative in the last 90 seconds, I'd be pretty discouraged. You know, look, I think it depends. Well, I hope it's not a commentary on the Marine Corps. I know you're a great Marine, but that's a friendly banter there. But no, here's the way I look at it. Number one, you have to have a standing army because there is no time to mobilize a reserve component force with the speed of war the way things are today. So you have to have an army that is prepared and available. But in terms of the make work, I didn't see it, but I look at it through this lens. There is so much to do to prepare for war. The tasks and requirements to prepare for a war where you are effective and you dominate is just, they're just endless tasks. And once you get done with one, you got to go back to the original one. And so if you imagine a symphony, When the United States military goes to war, the integration of all the capabilities we have, whether it be air, whether it be ground, whether it be maritime, whether it be tanks, et cetera, the integration requirements is massive. It's like a symphony, but you've also got to train on your own individual instrument. So all of these things are continually training, because once you get good at one, you've got to go back to the other, and then maybe your skill set starts to wane in the original. So it's just a constant effort to train the team on individual skills and then the collective integration.
Interesting you mentioned a symphony. I mean, I would just, sometimes it's like, yes, let's say a war is a symphony, and peacetime, well, you're not allowed to play as a symphony. You can take private lessons, but you can't practice all the time. And you've got to like vacuum clean the symphony hall, and you've got to make sure that your tuxedo looks great for opening night. And like, what else do you got to do? You got to take care of the people who work in the box office. And oh, then you got to every now and then get back to playing your instrument. And then maybe you'll be able to play with some others on certain occasions. But and then when it all comes together, somehow it comes together. But I don't know. I just felt like so much of what we did, or not just in the Marine Corps, but others, like had not all that much to do with war fighting. Occasionally. I mean, well, not occasionally, a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I suppose it is relevant to one's experiences. But, you know, when you've got an institution as large as the United States military that has to be self-contained when it goes to war, there's a lot of skill sets that you might not think is directly related to war fighting. So, for example, logistics, supply, petroleum management, and those jobs and those skills have to be on hand. But the daily activities for those that have those experiences might not be as intense as a combat arms maneuver command or organization. So, but you got to have them, right? You got to have logistics. You got to have sustainment. You got to have petroleum products. And so I think there might be areas that you described that are accurate that aren't as intensely engaged. But for the most part, I think it's a constant management of the symphony on all aspects that would come with your expectations of that.
Well, folks, this is what you see. I got off of active duty as a captain, and Eric got off active duty as a 3-star general. So you're seeing the expertise right there of a general. I mean that, Eric. I mean, I'm like you. You understand and all this stuff at a much higher level than anybody, especially me. And you know, I did leave active military service as a captain. I stayed in and made lieutenant colonel in the reserves, but. No, and you've thought about this stuff, and it's amazing, your expertise. So look, let's just go to the I want to get to the Iraq War and what happened there. Well, let's go right to that now then. All right, so I wanted to ask you about the woke culture and things like that that are happening in the military that do seem to be more in line with some of my observations than the previous one. That it's all distracting us and a lot of wasted time and virtue signaling in the military has no place. So we'll get to that in a few minutes. So, all right, where were you on 9/11?
9/11, I was assigned, I was at Fort Stewart, Georgia, where the home of the 3rd Infantry Division. I worked for a brigade commander named Colonel David Perkins. I was his operations officer. And frankly, to your point, I was in my office working email when the news became apparent to all of us. That was, as you and we all recall, a shocking day. But we were watching it on TV like everybody else.
And you knew right away everything was going to be different. Like, you're definitely going to war. Was that sense? And did you immediately start doing things? Was there anything special to do in the aftermath or right away?
You know, it's ironic. We... At the time, our assistant division commander at the 3rd Infantry Division then was a gentleman you'll know the name of, Lloyd Austin. He was a brigadier general at the time. The commanding general was gone, as I recall, that day. And he pulled everybody together, all the senior leaders, field grade officers, majors and above, into the conference room. And a couple things I remember him saying. First thing was, this is a really bad day and it's going to get worse. Because at that time, we knew the Pentagon had been hit, but we didn't know the degree or the scope of casualties. And as he said, we're all going to know some names tomorrow morning. So it's a really bad day. The second thing is, he said, you know, the world has changed. And we this division is going to find itself deployed in a place at a time, neither of which we know, but get ready. And so it was a sobering moment to hear that directly from him at the time.
All right. So, and then how's morale? Is everybody just like chomping at the bit to get over there and do something?
Well, the first was shock, as with everybody. And then you start processing, okay, we're going to deploy to this, to a theater of war, whether it be Afghanistan or Iraq soon. So we've got to get ready. And then as you know, muscle memory sets in and you've absorbed what has happened, then you start thinking about, okay, where would we be deployed? And as a heavy division, which the 3rd Infantry Division was, it became pretty clear as you listen to the narrative of the then Bush administration that what would be most likely, while our infantry divisions would go to Afghanistan, this problem, the perceived problem in Iraq was going to become increasingly important, and we knew that we would probably be going there. The other thing you have to remember at that time is we were rotating brigades into Kuwait at the time as a deterrent action against Iraq. And so we were on a rotation of brigades that were going to the desert in Kuwait to train, but all primarily to deter any kind of activity by Saddam Hussein against Kuwait.
So you're talking about Iraq amongst yourselves much earlier than anyone on the national scene, or at about the same time?
Well, it was about the same time. Recall that, you know, there was a lot of talk and speculation in the media to what degree was Saddam Hussein involved. Then there was also a narrative that talked about, you know, given the way the world has changed, is this a time, I'm talking about public discussion at this time, is this a time to solve the Iraq problem while we have, you know, the motivation, incentive, resourcing? And so that talk was in. So when you synthesize all that, you know that at a minimum, you're going to go to Kuwait on these rotational deterrence missions. But if the commander in chief wanted to reconcile this longstanding challenge that we had with Iraq, now would be the time. And so either way, you knew you were going to be engaged.
Now, was there, did you go to Afghanistan?
I didn't go to Afghanistan until 2010. I did two tours in Afghanistan, two tours in Iraq.
Did you, so none of there wasn't that kind of competition to go to Afghanistan like there was, say, to go to Saudi Arabia and Kuwait in 1990. It was like, we're going to get our chance eventually, right?
Well, that didn't become apparent, though, Greg, until around 2004, 2005, that, you know, this was the long war. And what we thought, I think, is we would reconcile the Afghanistan problem, we would reconcile the Iraq problem, and then based on our memory of the 91 Gulf War, that it would be over fairly quickly, and then we would go home. It wasn't until the insurgency began to take root in Iraq in around the 2004 time period that people started to realize, oh, we're going to do this for a long time, and there will be plenty of rotations.
No, I mean, like, yeah, all right, but like when Afghanistan was raging in October of 2001. You had your hands full getting ready for the Iraq contingency, or, you know, we're going to be doing stuff for a while at least. So there wasn't that kind of like we're missing out kind of sensation, right?
Oh, yeah. No, I there was no sensation of missing out on Afghanistan. We knew that our time was coming.
Yeah. So you start getting ready for Iraq. Yes, there is a public debate, but the Bush administration seems very intent. We know the direction is going. The UN resolution is passed in 2002. You guys are just wargaming, you're planning, what are you doing?
Oh gosh. Well, again, remember what I described. It's like a football team. You got to get your individual skills right. So we trained our tank crews on gunnery, and then we would go to perform gunnery competitions. And then once that, you know, individual crew was trained on its ability to operate the tank, then we would pull them together, and then we start doing maneuver exercises at the platoon level with four tanks. And then we'd add to that, and then we'd do company exercises. And then we went all the way up to a brigade training event at the National Training Center out in Fort Irwin, California. So you slowly put more of the symphony together. You slowly put more of the football team out on the gridiron and start to operate the way you would conduct operations in a potential war in the future. Ultimately, remember I described rotation. So one of our sister brigades came out of Kuwait, and in September 2002, Colonel Perkins, now General Perkins, deployed the brigade to Kuwait. And for 6 months straight, prior to it becoming apparent that there was going to be an invasion of Iraq, that brigade trained every single day and got really, really good. I would argue that that brigade, prior to the war, 2nd Brigade and 3rd Infantry Division, was probably the best trained heavy brigade in history because of the amount of time and resources we had to be able to conduct operations. We would conduct live fire operations at night with zero visibility that would just it would stun you in terms of the ability of this brigade. And for those who don't know, a brigade, it's got about 5,000 people in it. It's got three or four battalions of about 40 to 44 combat vehicles each. So about 100 tanks or so, and then Bradley fighting vehicles.
Wow. Live firing, zero visibility at night. That is, it's dangerous and it's complex and it's very, very difficult. Where were you doing that?
In the desert of Kuwait. You know, Kuwait is a city state for the most part. Kuwait City, right there on the coast, very small country, as everybody's seen maps of it. But everything beyond Kuwait City is just desert. There are a marginal number of Bedouin tribes out there, but we would park those brigades and we would live out in the desert for that 6 to 8 month period before the war kicked off.
When did you get there? Do you remember?
Yeah, I think it was August, September of 2002. So about 8 months before things started to unfold.
By the way, when you're an officer and you're working, you were the XO, correct? Wait, no.
Yeah.
Yes.
I was the brigade operations officer, and then I became the brigade XO, yes.
You have, it seems like, no time for yourself. I remember on deployment, it just felt like, you know, if you were tending to your own matters, you were falling behind or you were not, you know, it was just like kind of a crisis mode all day long. Was that the tempo?
Oh, the tempo was really high because over the course, once we went on there in September 2002, it was becoming increasingly clear that there was going to be a ground invasion of Iraq. And so you take that very seriously. So there's no leaf unturned, and you're constantly checking everything. You want to make sure you're trained on all the skills that you may need, and there's just not enough time. So, you know, you're starting with PT in the morning at about 6, and you're not shutting down till probably 11 o'clock at night.
So you're getting ready, and then somebody has the idea to bring a bunch of reporters along for the invasion. How long, who was talking about that? How did this happen as an idea to embed correspondence with live television capability, of which I would be one. We'll talk about that. But who introduced that?
You know, I like to think this embedded reporter idea at least had roots in the 2nd Brigade of the 3rd ID. I remember talking to Colonel Perkins a lot about this topic, because remember, our memory as we're in Kuwait at the time was CNN reporting on the Gulf War in 91 from the hotel in Baghdad. And both he and I said, you know, this time it's going to be different because of the ability to use satellite phones, mobile satellite dishes, that instead of reporting on this war from Baghdad, this war would be reported from the ground because we could embed reporters and they'd have the ability to have sufficient communications to broadcast it. And so early on, it was in the fall, I think it was September, October, when we were doing one of our first exercises, we proposed to the command in Kuwait to train that activity. You know, if we're going to train our soldiers on how to operate a tank, we probably ought to train how we integrate reporters if that's what's going to happen. It's not just something you do. You got to train it and practice it. So there was a brigade exercise that we did, and we proposed this idea to the commanding general in Kuwait to bring reporters in, and we practice how they would operate within the formation. And it was that around that time, I think, that you and I started talking. I also had a chance to talk to Brian Kilmeade at Fox News, and we imagined that you would probably need a vehicle, right? And so I think we encouraged Fox to buy a Humvee because a Humvee would have common or at least similar parts to those that we use, so we could help sustain the vehicle. But the point is, this was something we started talking months ahead of time, and we practiced it, we trained it, and through the process, I think we built some great relationships with our media partners.
But what was the, I met you, I remember, it was, I think, January or February of 2002. It was just prior to things getting underway.
2003, you mean.
You're right, I'm sorry, 2003. So what was the intent, though? All right, like, why, it's going to be different, they have the capability. You wanted to, there had to be strategic intent. You know, we're going to have these reporters with live capability in war. Like, what was the benefit for the military? And did you consider that, look, if we take casualties, if this happens, if that happens, we're going to have, nobody wants to have a crew of live TV correspondents when things are going terribly. So did you factor all that in? But again, what was the strategic intent for you guys?
Well, this is a great debate, and there was a lot of discussion on this, and all of your points are important. first thing I would say is, remember, we've had reporters embedded with us in war for, you know, as long as war has existed. There is merit, number one, accountability. That's why we have a free media. So that's important. What was unique to this war, though, this is an important question, because if you're going on live TV describing what an American or coalition outfit is doing, the first reaction by some might be, why aren't you losing operational security by doing that? There is a risk at that, which I'll come to that, but I'll come back to it in a moment. But the strategic intent was, given communications the way it is worldwide, given the fact that anybody can get an uplink and go on the news, we wanted to be first with the news, number one. Two, we wanted to show the absolute dominance that we knew we would be able to employ, so that you could create momentum for the campaign so that it doesn't last as long as it otherwise might. So we knew that we would dominate in this war, and we wanted to demonstrate that worldwide so that the momentum would move in our direction. You brought up an interesting point. You said, you know, what about the display of casualties that could be splashed across evening news in a way that might be insensitive or difficult? You might remember this, Greg, I'm sure you do, but one of the virtues of embedding media is you build relationships. And I think very quickly, those that were embedded with us recognized the sensitivities to that, and were going to show respect to the outfit that reporter is fighting with. You know, let's be honest, the reporter is dependent on that organization for security, for food, for any number of things. And so it doesn't compromise the reporter, but it does, I think, mitigate the maybe some more brash behaviors of those that might not respect what's going on. So it was a mitigating, that relationship mitigated any kind of many of the risks that you described. I'll give you an example, if you want to jump to this, but you recall when you were with Dave Perkins in downtown Baghdad, and I was at a command post about 6 kilometers south, and our command post was destroyed by a missile, and a surface-to-surface missile. And that was a bad day. We talked about bad days in the last hour. I remember your team, who hadn't gone downtown with you, asking if they could go live with that strike. And I talked to your team and I said, look, this is a pretty significant strike. I would appreciate it if you would hold for now and not report it, because it was a pretty effective hit. And that could have given them some encouraging, you know, news. Your team was willing to hold until they came to me a little later and said the AP had picked it up. I said, okay, run with the story. But that's the, you know, the kind of conversations we would have. I remember you coming in to a command post and getting a briefing on the entire campaign into downtown Baghdad. And what did we do? We trusted the reporters wouldn't reveal that before it took place, but we did it so you would have the context of why the campaign was going to be carried out the way sure. It was, why the tactics we were going to
do. Let me jump. You guys came up with a list of ground rules that I remember was very long. I'm not sure if we signed them or whatever, but the ground rules, if you're going to come with us in a vehicle and we're going to provide you with security and food and all these things, you got to play by these rules. And any savvy newsmaker is going to have ground rules. Now, these were more involved, and that's totally fine, and we accepted it because it was a bit more complex. I do remember one of the ground rules. We could essentially, we couldn't necessarily say where we were, but we could show and talk about and display what we were seeing. And it's like what do they say? The plan is good right up until the first bullet is shot. And I remember shortly after we crossed the Euphrates River, a tank had sustained significant damage by whether it was a rocket propelled grenade or something. And the tank was on fire. And we were showing that. It was live television, and it was quite a moment. Then shortly after that, you'll remember, maybe you don't, but we got frantic calls to turn off our camera. Frantic. I mean, I can't remember the name of the officer, but they were upset, and they were just like very direct. And by that point, actually, our camera had stopped working anyway. But we had captured this, and we had the world saw it, a tank on fire, and I was narrating, and we went by it. I was very scared, apprehensive perhaps, but it was like, okay, they got the tank. We're not in an armored vehicle. We went by the tank, and we were worried, and I went into a very technical explanation of what was happening and what we were seeing, and I was talking kind of like this. But at that moment, they were saying, turn off the camera, turn off the camera. Not right at that moment. Like, by the time the Pentagon saw it, I heard it came from higher headquarters. Turn off your camera. Go ahead.
That's a key point. Those instructions that you were getting, and it happened a couple times, as I recall, really came from much higher headquarters. And it's interesting because if you recall, Colonel Perkins and I were much more sanguine and willing to let you report. And the reason, you know, Colonel Perkins viewed it that way is if you are reporting a tank on fire where you're at, the only, you're not reporting grids or locations, but you were able to report on it. Anybody that had any need for that information already knew it was happening anyway. In other words, if we're in contact with our opponents and they hit that tank and it starts to burn, they know it already. The fact that the Pentagon could see it had no material impact because you weren't reporting the location. So it was really a moot point that you were showing a tank on fire. But I think that those at the higher headquarters hadn't come to grips with the fact that we know who we're in contact with. We know who we're not in contact with. And the fact that Greg Kelly is reporting live on TV about a burning tank was largely immaterial to us at the tactical level.
Largely immaterial to us. Yeah, no, I totally understand. But I guess I wonder if this is ever going to happen again, as our technology has gotten a lot better in 18 years. And, you know, you can live stream from a battlefield. You can live stream. Think about it, that. Anybody could do what we did in 2003. You know, it took a lot of equipment. It took, you know, thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of special satellite equipment. And now anybody with a phone can do what we were doing in 2003.
And this is part of the point. This is not going away. And so,
are you sure about that? I mean, like, how do we know that? Now, if you really did a top to bottom review, and we're going up against North Korea, and you want to have a bunch of reporters with their own phones being able to show things live, and the entire world debate forget about the Pentagon, everybody in the world debate your actions while you're performing them. That's a big problem. It would make your job possibly impossible.
Yeah, I'm not saying I like that. I'm just what I'm describing is with the world the way it is, and so it does make it harder, a lot harder. But I think that rather than deny it or pretend it doesn't exist or you employ draconian measures that would remove that accountability I talked about earlier, I think is more problematic than trying to integrate it appropriately.
I mean, it's not that draconian. I mean, to say you can't have cell phones over here, or you know what? We're going into battle. We're going into war. You can't come. I mean, you can do that. You can say that. That can be a policy. I just don't see a bunch of people watching an invasion, FaceTiming it, streaming it, whatever the hell they're doing, whatever they will be doing in 5 years or whenever. It's just... but you're more familiar with the Army and where you guys are right now. You just left not too long ago. That's the mindset. Like embedding is here to stay, and whatever we do is going to be covered live everywhere.
Look, we're gonna obviously try to shape it, but what just always remember what makes us different as a nation, or you know, alongside our partners, is that we do have an open and free press. And some of our peers who have ill intentions don't always have an open press. And I think it's one of the things that has always set us apart. We're not perfect. We have problems just like China and Russia might have problems. But we do put ourselves or allow ourselves to be held accountable to a free press. And so to remove that, I think then makes us no better than our opponent.
Well,
and
wait, so, just to be accountable to a free press. I mean, first of all, I don't like the idea of being accountable to a free press. Is it the free press can hold you accountable or anybody accountable? I mean, if you look at the press, how corrupt and dishonest and out for themselves, and they're just, now it's become clickbait central. And that's like, you know, to be accountable, you can be accountable to your country, to laws, to the Uniform Code of Military Justice, but I don't think they're worthy of being of accountability. You should not be held accountable to the press, to the and the Constitution, by the way, says nothing about that. It doesn't.
Well, I think you corrected me appropriately. I should say accountable to our nation, to voters, to the electorate, but the only way they can hold us accountable is to have some kind of transparency on what is and what has happened. Because look, we all have broken souls, right? And so if not accountable in some way to our civilian oversight or to the electorate, then you will see behaviors of armies that won't act appropriately as they should. And you can start to see manipulation if there isn't transparency involved.
Well, transparency means different. Go ahead.
I mean, if we think the press can be compromised, and they can, is it not also true that an army can be compromised? So we want transparency that allows information, access to information, so that we know what happened and we know that we behaved appropriately or hold people accountable appropriately.
Well, it sounds terrific in a philosophical sense. But when you have a bunch of 24-year-olds with cell phones, each of them with a financial motive to become famous or to just, you know, a viral video and something which is completely out of context, and I don't think they go together. And I also, you say there have been embedded reporters since the beginning of time, and I guess so. Yeah, but back then, they weren't writing immediate accounts. They were writing books for later. Okay. 3 weeks later, you'd find their dispatch. And there is a huge tactical and strategic risk, I think, in having these people along. Nobody else could function that way, by the way. It's like, you know, take any White House. You bring him in after the meeting. You don't have him there during the meeting. I know Trump had him in sometimes during the meeting. But, you know, like, you can't just have people roaming around, you know, holding people accountable with their phones all the time. And they're not, their motives will never be pure. So I'm all about accountability, I guess, and all that stuff. But isn't that kind of on the army to keep itself accountable? I don't know.
I think so. And, but let me be clear. I'm not saying there should be no ground rules. You and I both talked about ground rules a little bit ago. And so, no, we don't want people all over the place broadcasting with their phone and taking isolated snapshots that might not be in context. That's why ground rules exist. I'm merely saying that we need to embrace this idea of an embedded media and understand it and build out that relationship in a way that is effective.
Well, the relationship part, you know, you can't, they'll always screw you in the end. They really will. I am one of the few exceptions. I can't do that. I mean, I just can't do that. I won't do that, particularly with people I like. And I don't even like the word journalism anymore because it's become almost meaningless and there's no standardization anymore. So, you know, building relationships.
So I don't disagree with you on that. And I think that the profession of journalism, whatever we would call it, needs to take a good solid look at themselves in terms of, you know, what is our professional ethic as reporters or as journalists? But going back to the relationship thing, I would say that there was merit in that, because when you do have mutual dependence, people's behavior is mitigated. I remember when we went to Fallujah several months later after the war had, the initial hostilities had ended, and we stopped embedding. And we had a reporter come in, didn't know him at all. He didn't know me. And we were a bit tired at that point in time, and I didn't supervise his engagement with our soldiers adequately. And he did a hit job on us and frankly, you might recall this, one of the soldiers had a fairly disrespectful comment about the Secretary of Defense.
I'd ask for his resignation. right?
Something to that effect, yes. And there might have been some inappropriate language associated with that too. And but that's a case where somebody came in, did a flash job, moved out. There was no relationship. I had inadequately supervised the engagement, and that's what can happen if you don't build the appropriate relationship.
Well, I'm saying that's going to happen. That's going to happen every single time. It's going to happen. You had a very unique situation with me and with Brian Kilmeade and with Fox, but that's not going to happen. Like you can't manage it to the extent where you really control that story. No one else can. And by the way, very few people in the Army have your sophistication when it comes to civil media relations, military media relations. Nobody understands it like you do. Very few, at least. I don't know. I feel like it's...
I always err on taking risk, but prudent risk in terms of engaging. I've never minded doing interviews, but I study very carefully who I'm going to do the interview with. I read some of their stories. I understand their background, and I prepare myself. I'm willing to take that risk. And look, there's some positives out of this. You remember some great stories describing some phenomenal behaviors by our soldiers in that war, and I think it is a testament to being willing to expose our great soldiers to the American people. Are there reporters that are going to do a hit job? Yes, they are. But it's part of the territory. And I would tell you, it was more than just Fox, Greg. We had a number of reporters embedded with 2nd Brigade, and it went. You know, David Zucchino wrote the book Thunder Run, which is a very accurate, objective account of the brigade's performance. So, and look, that book was a bestseller, I think, and they've talked about making it into a movie. That's a good story.
Yeah.
And so there is some benefits to bringing the media along.
Well, you were dealing with major media entities. You had Fox News. You had the LA Times. Zucchino was with the LA Times. You had David Blum of NBC. You had the Associated Press. You had, these are, you know, major league organizations that do play by, you know, certain set of rules. I don't know what's going to happen when BuzzFeed comes or Vox Media. Part of it was, like, back then, I don't know if they could have afforded to come. I mean, we were major corporations, and so who knows? But look, let's talk about the invasion itself. Look, I can I tell you, when I was at that hotel in Kuwait, and people were, all the reporters were there, 100 or so, and I was so skeptical that we would, number one, get to see anything. Number two, I was hoping that they would call the whole thing off because I didn't think it was necessary. I don't know. Did you pick up any of that from me? I don't remember what we had great conversations, and I was getting to know you and Colonel Perkins, which was really terrific. We would go out to see you in the field. But do you remember, was I voicing those feelings?
Yeah, if I could be honest, transparent, I saw you as a bit of a cynic, but I thought it was not a dysfunctional cynicism. You would ask really hard questions. And of course, you and I got along. And so privately, we would debate the merits of this potential campaign. And, you know, Greg, I didn't say this earlier, one of the things I liked about having reporters in the formation is they are unique in that they have a worldview that at least is somewhat consistent with the problems that we deal with in the Army. So there's a lot of professions that are very isolated back home in the United States, and they don't get exposed to some of these world international problems. But reporters are typically very well educated, and they've been abroad. Same with soldiers. The problem in the military is sometimes we think alike because we're a very tight-knit culture. So I loved having you or other reporters debate me on the merits of any given political topic, or at that time, the topic associated with the eventual campaign, because it made me think. It was disruptive, and it was really helpful to have a professional that has a worldview that's been exposed similar to ours.
And so you'll remember, and you can confirm, that I didn't think the invasion was a good idea. I wasn't, and this was stuff that we would say over coffee, over, you know, like it wasn't, I wouldn't start any conversation or the business of the day by saying, we shouldn't be here. But you definitely picked up on that I thought the idea of invading Iraq was unnecessary.
I did, yes.
No, I like that. I don't. All right, it's interesting. And I did say the only thing I said on air that I thought was when we got back, I was like, they said, Greg, is there anything that told you, you know, we were doing the right thing? What did you see over there where it finally made sense to you that we were doing the right thing? And I was actually on Fox and Friends, and it was live. And who was it? Rick Leventhal jumped in and said, well, as soon as you saw the faces of the kids, you knew we were doing the right thing. And I'm like, oh, phew, I'm off the hook. And this was, by the way, May 1st or the day before, April 30th, when we were major combat operations were declared over. And so they finally come to me and they say, and Greg? And I said, well, nothing I saw over there changed my mind about whether or not this war needed to be fought. And I remember there was kind of like a pause after it, and I didn't say anything, and it was kind of awkward. And my dad called me up afterwards, kind of said, hey, stop being so cute, you know? Basically get on board. I mean, we won this thing, and I had a bad feeling about it even then that things were still. Yeah. Anyway, so dude, you totally, I mean, it was amazing to see you in combat, to see it all work, to see everything. And you, by the way, you were confident. You just, you were having a little bit of fun in a good way. Everything kind of went according to plan. Would you agree? And I tell you, it was so exciting. The first big night was the shelling of, what do we do? Those paladins started to, we had an artillery barrage, right?
Yeah. Well, when we initiated the barrage.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let me back up though very quickly, because the original campaign timeline, I think had it taking about 120 days to finally get to Baghdad and turn the government. 120 days. And I remember Speaker Gingrich came to the desert. He was on, I think, the advisory board for the Pentagon at the time. And he wanted to hear for himself so he could report back to Secretary Rumsfeld what was in the realm of possible. And I remember we were in a tent and we were briefing Speaker Gingrich on the campaign plan. And it was still very slow, deliberate campaign plan as drafted at the time. And Speaker Gingrich turned to then Colonel Perkins, a fairly junior ranking officer relative to the speaker's role and rank at the time. And he said, if you could have it your way, how long would it take you to get to Baghdad? And without missing a beat, Colonel Perkins said, I could do it in 2 weeks. And relative to a campaign plan that was drawn out to 120 days. Well, as you recall, that's ultimately what happened. It was a bold statement. I think the general officer in the room's jaw dropped, but he was right. And we were confident because we knew we were that good. Now, back to your question, one of the things, you know, as you kick off a war like this, particularly for somebody like me who had never been in war, you don't know what's going to happen. What I remember was that the hostilities kicked off and the campaign progressed as if I was out at Fort Irwin, California in a training exercise. It was going exactly as we had expected. You know, we wanted to take out the outposts on the border first so we could penetrate. That's the first activity that happened. I think that's what you're referring to.
Yeah. Yeah. And then crossing the border the next day. I mean, it was just like, it was so wild. It was out of a movie and it was just like kind of going perfectly. Now let's just talk about that. It's interesting. So you think Gingrich ran back to Rumsfeld and says, I'm hearing that this can be done a lot quicker.
I'm not sure he ran back, but I do know we knew at the time that Secretary Rumsfeld wanted some of his advisors just to pull the thread of information so he could get a better understanding of the campaign plan. And I'm sure they probably went back and had a discussion, and I'm sure that was probably one of the topics at hand.
So
do I know that for a fact? No, but that's why he was there.
Now let's talk about the speed of which we got to Baghdad, which was pretty quick. You know, and Tommy Franks though, wasn't that his intent also? He wanted to get there. He wanted to get there very quickly. Correct? I thought he was pushing that.
I anybody would. I don't remember specifically what General Frank said at the time. I know that it went much faster than what the campaign as drafted would have had us move. So the reason is you just can't stop a brigade. A country like Iraq couldn't like ours at the time. And we just wanted to keep pressing, because the slower you go, interesting, again, talking human behavior, the slower you carry out a campaign, the more the opponent can adjust psychologically, physically, posturing tactically. So fast campaigns have a shock effect that overwhelms your opponent. And so going too slow is not good, because it they can too adequately absorb what's happening and adjust to it.
Well, we had a very light, compared to 1990, 1991, a very light force. How many people were involved in the invasion? It wasn't big at all, comparatively.
Golly, Greg, you caught me short on this one. I think it was, I want to say between 150 and 200,000.
And back then, I think it was like 500,000 to 600,000. It was like, right? It was much, much bigger.
Right. And then, and there was the, you know, the debate that preceded those activities on the Hill with General Shinseki believing it was going to require a lot more.
So I guess the thing about it is, and I heard this line once, and then Tommy Franks was running around saying, well, speed kills, speed kills. And somebody made the observation, again, this is years after the invasion, and they were saying, well, speed doesn't kill, it just passes your enemy by. And that, well, we made some assumptions that if Baghdad toppled, you know, the whole regime would fall, and, you know, we'd win. And by the way, those things happened. And we did win, but we won basically the battle. We did not win the war. I guess that's the thing. We thought we won the war, but we had just won a battle, and nobody had really planned for or considered the war. Now, I know some people did, I'm sure, but is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, there's a couple things going on here. With open communications, free media, combined with the United States ethic, United States military's ethic, and combined with the fact that our weapon systems have become so accurate and so precise, that war today is, it is harder to vanquish your opponent. And when, and vanquish is a very specific term I'm using, because when the whole culture knows that they've been defeated, and it's ugly and it's powerful, you will see the culture behave differently. If you look at what happened in Japan as an example, that was a vanquished culture after World War II. And so the culture tends to abide by the transition when you install a new government or you have, you know, peacekeepers, et cetera, because they've been vanquished, right? But in the war that you and I saw, people were watching from their windows as we were going up Highway 1 towards the center of Baghdad. They could watch the war unfold from you know, several hundred meters away. That's a unique circumstance. We used to have to carpet bomb because our bombs didn't have accurate systems on them to put them on a precise target. So now when you go to war, it's very difficult with our ethics, with, as you mentioned earlier, live TV and the precise weapon systems to justify the casualties that come with a vanquished opponent. Does that make sense?
Yep, totally.
And so I think that what we found was that you had a culture that didn't feel as if they'd been defeated. They just felt that their government had been defeated. And then the second aspect of this, I think you touched on, is we do very well at planning for a war. We do very poorly at planning for the aftermath of a war. And it's very difficult work. I remember at the time, Secretary Rumsfeld was scrutinizing the numbers of soldiers that were going to be over there and scrutinizing the campaign plan. And I remember saying to Colonel Perkins at the time, I said, I wish the senior leadership would focus more on the aftermath. We've got this war thing. We'll handle that. But what will ensue? What then? It reminds me of Robert Redford's movie, The Candidate. You know, he spends all his time running for Senate, I believe, or governor, and he finally wins the election, gets in the limousine, and then says to his aides, okay, now what? You know, so really, I think we need to do a lot better looking at the aftermath and the transition from hostilities to the policy that ensues.
By the way, just going back to our conversations before the war started, I want to point out that I wasn't just like this guy who thought he knew everything and this is silly. And that wasn't my attitude, as you know. But I had spent a fair amount of time in Kuwait while I was in the military, and I had flown over Iraq in Operation Southern Watch. And one of the reasons why I was skeptical about the whole campaign is when George W. Bush started talking about, well, Saddam's been firing at our pilots and needs to be held to account. That was one of the justifications for the war. And I knew firsthand that, well, he had never shot anybody down. The surface-to-air threat was nil. And that was just, it was a kind of a phony reason. And but part of the, you know, it helped my reporting and it hurt my reporting that I had been exposed, that I had lived the military life. So when I got to Kuwait, you know, I had already been there. I know what it was like to live in a tent. I wasn't treating all of this with a sense of awe and wonder that I think some other reporters were. I once heard somebody, like, he did a report about how he prepared his MRE, and it was actually a pretty good report. And I didn't even think that was interesting. Like, for me, the audience right. would find it interesting, but too often I focused on what was interesting to me and not what might be interesting to the audience. And that was just, so I was learning on my own and evolving. This is fairly early in my journalism career. Hey, the invasion itself, just, I mean, there are too many stories to go into, or maybe we should do that again, but I mean, there are just some incredible moments of things happening, and it was all a jumble. Did you ever sit down and write, you know, you must have. You have an after action report, and you could methodically go, you know, here we were on day 8, day 9. Were you able to ever process all of those experiences? Because some of them were really wild.
Yeah, I think that it's almost as if during that 2-week period, there are these little vignettes that are in sequence over that time, and in sequence from Kuwait all the way to downtown Baghdad. And each of the stories are fascinating in and of themselves. I think in terms of processing, sure. I mean, there's a lot of time to think through what had happened, and I would walk myself in sequence over time as to how the whole thing played out. Over the years, some of that drifts, but I do have, as an example, I do have all the logs that we had. Have I ever synthesized it in any kind of written product? No. But I have, with keen interest, read a number of the books that have been written, and it helps you process it from a different person's lens, and you can put yourself in context. But yeah, fascinating stories of great heroism, sometimes failure, but all very significant human experiences.
The stuff we did at night, I found very, I don't know, the one time I felt bullets whizzing by us when we got to Baghdad, and we're going to have to talk about that next time. I do want there to be a part 3, if you don't mind, but I remember driving in a Humvee at night, and Mal was driving, and you couldn't see anything. And I know he had NVGs, but NVGs are tricky things, and we were driving not on a road, but we were driving just across the sand, and I really felt like we were in trouble. It's so funny that the most frightened I was in a vehicle accident at one point, even though, you know, we saw all kinds of real combat. That's the time that I thought, and as soon as we got to wherever the hell we were going, I respectfully told Mal that he could not drive anymore, and we needed to upgrade a couple of things. So, but that just stands out. And I think when we got to where we were going, I don't know if you remember this, but we threw together like a planning session really fast. It was at night, and there were lights. And do you remember, like, this is fun? You were like, we're going to be talking about this for a long time. Do you remember that?
I do remember what you're talking. I think we had crossed the Euphrates, and there was an opportunity for a final push to Baghdad. And we were well ahead of schedule. We had, and it was probably 2 a.m. in the morning. We dropped the back ramps. And essentially what the commanding general at the time asked Colonel Perkins is, can you keep going? And we had gone from Osamawa all the way up north to crossing the river. And we laid out in this open desert. Colonel Perkins called his battalion commanders together. And what we were trying to do is get to Baghdad before the Hammurabi division repositioned, which was north of Baghdad at the time, as I recall. And so the idea was to get to Baghdad before they repositioned. And so we were laying out the tactical maneuvers that we were going to use to achieve that. And it was 2 a.m. We hadn't slept in probably a day and a half. And I remember looking at Colonel Perkins, and this is a rare moment when you have a field commander who has the opportunity to move fast, to posture himself more quickly than another formation that you're up against. And I remember looking at Colonel Perkins and I said, sir, you loving this? Because it is the pinnacle of a combat situation where things are going your way and you have the opportunity to really just lock it down. And that's what he was planning at the time. And you were there and you were listening in on it. And within about 3 or 4 hours, I think the brigade would kick off again and not stop until it got to Baghdad.
Just incredible times. Let's just jump ahead. What happened in Fallujah? You mentioned we had a conversation and I thought you were trying to manipulate me and I called you out on it. But what was that all about?
Yeah, and this is important because it's important to tell not just victory stories, but also stories of failure, you know, because that's when you really learn. And you recall the reason we were in Fallujah is this insurgency was starting to demonstrate itself, and we were having, Fallujah was a particularly hard town. And so our brigade left Baghdad and we went to Fallujah. And we were trying to suppress what was a growing insurgency. As the XO at the time, you were interviewing me and asking me how it's going. And I don't remember specifically what I said, but I'm sure I was giving you a positive report. And you allowed me to, you know, we were on air and you allowed me to, you know, to articulate the positive things that were happening in Fallujah. And when the camera went off, you said to me, and we were friends, right? And you said, come on, man, you're spinning me, Eric. And that hit me like a ton of bricks because, number one, you know, if as a leader in the military, you're talking to the American public, you want to have integrity with what you are describing. And I got called out by not only a reporter for spinning the truth or what was happening, but I also got called out by my friend. Mm. So I did some serious self-evaluation after that because we have to be very transparent. We don't have to, you know, sell ourselves down the river. It's okay to describe good things that are happening, but when someone perceives that they are being spun, then you are in a position where integrity is in question. And so I had to really rethink back on what I said that day and how I was portraying the campaign publicly. And it was healthy for me. I learned a lot.
Well, the thing about it is, look, everybody spins. It's okay. You know, everybody wants to put their best foot forward. You're not just informing the American public. You know, you were a lieutenant colonel by then, or are you still a major? You're not.
I was a lieutenant colonel.
Okay, you're a lieutenant colonel, and you know you're not that, which is mid-level in the officer rank. You're on your way to being a general, but you have a lot of bosses. You have, and you got the Pentagon watching, and you've got all these other entities that you've got to worry about, constituencies, not just the American people. You got to take care of yourself. You got to take care of me. It's just a very delicate line to walk. And these are some of, and not everybody's up to it. And the most convenient thing to do is to talk about how great everything is going. So,
but there's a problem with that too, though, because look, we're still in Afghanistan. Now it looks like we are withdrawing imminently, right? But the joke in the White House when I worked there is that every tour or every year, the commanders are saying, we're just, you know, 6 months away from, you know, quenching the insurgency. And that's not a good reputation to have. I remember one aide to President Obama said, the good news is there is no problem that the United States military doesn't think they can solve. The bad news is it's not getting solved. And so confidence and positive stories are good, but we were telling those positive stories for a long time. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't do that, but all I'm saying is it merits reflection. You know, what is that balance that you're describing, and how do we balance information with the facts on the ground, with information campaign, psyops, all that kind of thing?
Well, here's something, and it started to set in a couple of years later, but generally speaking, reporters seldom know more than the subject matter expert or whoever they're interviewing. They just are observers, and they just don't know more than the people they're covering. People they're covering have access to a lot more information. But that actually, I noticed a shift a few years later, because you would have these units come in and out of Iraq, and they'd stay there for 6 months or a year. But reporters, some of them were gaining, very few, by the way, but some, like me, were gaining kind of, I don't want to say expertise, but, you know, real kind of long-form historical knowledge on what was happening there. And each unit that came to Fallujah, there's something else going on here. There's unit rivalry, and, you know, our predecessors had it all screwed up. We're going to fix it. And then they leave, and then everyone was declaring victory as they left, declaring, you know, they're within their sphere. And then the next unit would come in and say, it's all screwed up. And I noticed this happening. And I noticed once I was in the Pentagon briefing room, actually, and it was a live interview from the Fallujah, somebody in Fallujah, brigade commander or something like that. And he was like the third person I saw from that exact location say the same thing over the past like 2 or 3 years. You know what I mean? Well, we came in here and there was a lot of resistance, but, you know, we reached out and we were working with the community now. And it became very, very repetitive. And I guess you know what I mean about the military, though, where they
come
in.
Very true. You know, it's a double-edged sword, because the alternative is to deploy units to a theater of war and leave them there until it's done. That would be really difficult to sustain, given the fact that we were in Afghanistan for 17 years. So 18, 19 years, rather. So therefore, we rotate units. The problem with rotating units is just as you described. When you go there, you know, there's no worse unit than the one you take over, no better unit than the one you leave, is a saying, right? And it's just it's human behavior. So we lose that longevity of understanding. The other dynamic is, you know, you go multiple times. So a lot of times when a unit would return to the States and then a year or two later go back over, the reference frame or their baseline was when they left, as opposed to understanding what had changed since they'd been over there. So it's really difficult when you're rotating units into a theater of war every year to have a coherent campaign. It's one of the challenges leaders face and have to overcome.
By the way, all the connectivity that your troops have with back home, and back then in 2003, 4, or 5, it was not as seamless as it is today. People have their own cell phones. They can keep in touch with it. How difficult was that? I mean, it's got to make things harder on both the people who were deployed and the people back home. It's nice to be able to call home. You know, in Vietnam, maybe you did that once every 3 months at best, letters. But now you kind of have this constant, everybody's in touch all the time. And I think it can be really bad. But you know more than me. What do you think?
Well, it's true. Because, you know, life goes on at home when you're deployed. And, you know, even if you take it down to the very tactical level, you know, an individual soldier, a private, a specialist calls home, and home is continuing. You know, you've got kids in school, maybe discipline problems at home, budget issues, you know, a family budget challenge, spouse gets in trouble at home. And so the soldier, rather than being solely focused on his job downrange, is having to process and synthesize the drama from home, right? And I'm not being irreverent, you know, the things at home are important too, but every day he's getting feedback. And so therefore, what we found was, you know, you probably heard of family readiness groups, you know, the role that the great, amazing role that military spouses play at home. Leaders had to be connected with their spouses to help manage the problems, the drama, the crises that were going on there, so that you didn't undermine the readiness of those soldiers that are, you know, calling home each day. And so it does add an element to warfare that didn't exist prior to since 9/11. Because you recall back in the Gulf War in 91, they were phone banks that you could get to once in a while, but cell phones weren't all over the battlefield. So it's a very recent phenomenon.
Yeah. So, hey, look, there's a lot more to talk about. I want to cut to your time in the White House. You worked in the White House from when to when?
Let's see. I went 2011 to 2013. I had, after Brigade Command, I went to Afghanistan. And I served as a senior planner in Afghanistan. And that experience lended itself to an interview with the Afghan desk inside the National Security Council. And Doug Lute was running that at the time, retired three-star general. And he hired me as one of the members of the team there.
That's pretty cool. So what was your title?
I was a director for Afghanistan, Pakistan, and but the job description really was anything to do with the military, anything to do with NATO, and anything to do with the Afghan army was in my portfolio. And so if it's NATO, Afghan army, and our army, that meant I had engaged the Pentagon, the State Department, Justice, anybody who had hands on those elements came through my desk into the National Security Council.
And what was your rank then?
I was a colonel, an 06 at the time.
So it was your job similar to what Alexander Vindman had?
You know, I have not. I know of Vindman. He was probably at the director level, but I haven't studied what he did in great detail. But let me describe the National Security Council quickly for those who don't know. It is an organization that really isn't on the books, so to speak, because all the people that work within the National Security Council are on loan from the interagency. So within the Afghan directorate that I worked for in Doug Lute, we had someone from the Central Intelligence Agency, we had someone from the CIA, we had someone from Justice, we had me from the Pentagon. And so the agencies loan someone at mid-career level to the National Security Council to staff the president, to oversee policy, and to develop policy. And that's an interesting phenomenon. It's actually what it does is it brings people into the White House who have recent experience. So in my case, I had just come back from Afghanistan. And so the Afghan desk then had a military guy that was just on the ground. The gentleman from the State Department that worked there had just been to Afghanistan working out of the embassy. And so what you do is you bring current information from the theater into the White House proper. Otherwise, you might get so far away from the problem as to not understand it.
And where did you go to work every day? Like, where was your office?
Yeah, if you look at the White House in the front, to the right side, within the campus, within the black fencing, is the old executive office building. The old executive office building is a Gothic gray-looking building that is about 4 or 5 stories tall. It is the original War Department prior to building the Pentagon, and it's now used to house staffers that work directly for the White House.
And the Vice President has an office there, and no, it's an amazing building, and that's where like a lot of the, not bureaucracy, but yeah, the staff work, and a lot of offices for the President are there, offices of the President. What was that life like? It's heady stuff working at the White House on the National Security Council.
It was fascinating. You know, I had, since I was a young kid, had always been fascinated by how our government employs power in politics and policy. And so I'd read a lot of books about those who worked in the White House, and it had kind of been a dream of mine. One of the merits of being in the Army is that you do have experiences that you wouldn't otherwise have. And so the fact that I was able to do this was real privilege, and I learned so much. What was it like? You know, first of all, I would tell you, it's a heady experience, I think the term you use, to walk through those gates each and every day. And I never got tired of it. It was hard work. And I could describe that. But every morning when I went through those gates, I knew that, number one, it was an honor and privilege. The other thing you know is that there's about 10 or 20 people lined up behind you. They'll take your job in a second. So, you know, work in the White House is thankless many times in terms of the amount of hours. I would get up at about 4 in the morning, and I'd be on the road by 4:40 to get to the metro. And then I'd take the metro in. I'd be in my office by 5:40. And during the week, I oftentimes wouldn't leave the White House till 9 or 10 at night. You know, I'd be getting off the metro at about 11 p.m. and know that in 5 hours I'm getting up and going at it again. And I would do that all week. And then Friday was a light night, and I'd be home to watch a movie with my family at 9. And I'd go in on Saturday. I'd work each Saturday, and probably once or twice a month I was even in on Sunday. So long hours of hard work. The other thing that was interesting is it was fascinating to work with interagency staffers. When you spend at that time, I was, you know, a colonel and had 20 some years in the Army. I mentioned it earlier, the military has a very homogeneous culture to it. And so we tend to think alike. It's also a hierarchical organization, and we do things in very deliberate ways. Working with the State Department, working with the Justice Department, working with the Central Intelligence Agency, all agencies that are much smaller than the Department of Defense, meant that the cultures of those agencies are different, and they think differently because they're raised differently, just like we were raised differently. So it was informative to understand how policy is made. And it's not unlike the Star Wars bar scene at times, because everybody comes to the sit room with different backgrounds, different experiences, and different cultural norms. And bridging those differences was the skill necessary in order to get advocacy for any given policy. So it was an amazing experience, and I learned a lot.
So let's talk about the president, President Obama. You were in a lot of rooms with him, and you observed him and interacted with him. What was he like?
I did. Yeah. So let me just put this in context. My natural political beliefs tend to be further to the right than his. And so I knew I was going into a Democrat White House that had different lens than I might have. But here's what I found immediately with President Obama. Number one, he's exceedingly bright. He's thoughtful, and he's articulate, and he's a hard worker. So when we would have a meeting, an NSC meeting in the White House on a particular policy for Afghanistan, we would usually prepare a paper for him to review ahead of time. Sometimes 18, 20 page document that, and I found that whenever he came into that NSC, he had not only read and studied it, the meeting started where the paper ended. So he was a hard worker, he was thoughtful, and I also thought, you know, within the cohort there, that he was a pretty good team builder in the room, that people tend to unify, and I think that's probably natural when you have the power of the presidency. But he had a certain charisma about him that I respected, and I knew you were going to get hard questions that were legitimate questions. And now, I didn't always agree with his views. I don't always agree with the background lens that he grew up with. I think that his perspective on some things, everything from the role of the United States, our history, To domestic issues, I might come down differently than him in a significant way. But I definitely thought he was a very thoughtful, hardworking president, and I was listening when he was talking.
By the way, when you have this job at the White House, you're out of the Army in a way. I mean, you're still being paid by the Army, but you're on loan. Is there a danger that your regular Army career can slip back or somehow be tainted? Or it's not necessarily the best thing for your Army career, or is it, to do a stint like this at the White House?
Well, I will tell you that a number of my mentors advised against it. They were worried that it would take me out of the mainstream of the Army, and they were worried that I would be polarized by going to a White House that of a particular party, and that might harm my ability to go back into the Army. I bet on it, though, because at the time, this is 2011, and at the time, the chief staff of the Army was wanting to encourage broader professional experiences so that we would maybe be more effective at advocating for policy in very complex places like Afghanistan and Iraq. And so I bet that this was not going to harm me. As it turned out, it didn't. But I think that's just something, that's a decision people have to make in their own careers. But I was willing to take the risk.
I mean, the schedule is ridiculous, by the way.
It was crazy.
Why was it so hard? I mean, that's almost unmanageable. 5 a.m. to 11 at night, going the whole time, working on Saturdays and occasionally Sunday. I mean, you kept that up for how long?
2 years. But you're right. It's an enormous schedule. And to this day, when the White House years come up with my wife, she looks over the top of her glasses at me as a first grade teacher might have. And I get the look. Those were tough years. Why is it that way? When you think about it, the NSC is a pretty small organization. I don't know where it's at right now, but at times it's gone to around 300. Remember what I described? I was processing everything from requests for information to papers to any number of documents, policy documents from multiple agencies. Any of them, if they touched the Afghan military, NATO, or U.S. military, came through my desk, and I'm one guy. And so the volume of information that's going both ways is fairly enormous. And so because I didn't have a staff under me. You're an individual who is doing your own staff work. The second reason why it might be that way is because they can. As I said, there's whenever you go through those gates, there's about 10 to 20 people that would take your job in a second. And so if you're unwilling to work that hard, it might not last as long as you would expect it to.
Is it because
others are willing to come in?
Sure. But is some of it like people are just naturally wound up because it's the president, that perhaps the same amount of work or the work could be done? If people spend a hell of a lot of time, excited and worked up because, everyone is kind of worked up because, oh my God, the boss is coming and it's the president and, he needs this or he may want that. And just a lot of it is
absolutely that way. And that was the other thing I observed is I've never seen, I almost call it voltage or magnetism around a single person and his purposes. And there's this interesting dynamic in the White House. It is almost there is a desire. The closer you are to the Oval Office, the more important you are. And so there's this desire to migrate closer and closer to the Oval because it establishes your value within that culture. It's just a strange phenomenon that, I think that who was it that worked for President Clinton, George Stephanopoulos, I think proudly had a closet where he operated adjacent to the Oval Office because proximity is everything, or attendance to meetings. The name of the game is, did I get in the meeting? Am I on the list? Even if you're a backbencher, right? And there's this subconscious thing that gives you value because you're in the meeting. So it's a very unhealthy magnetism that is imbued within everybody that works there that can be dysfunctional if you don't meter it and go home and look at reality, the real world, because it's a puzzle palace in many ways.
What an amazing guy, huh? Very, very smart. Very, very thoughtful. We have another conversation coming. Three parts. It'll be 4 hours with this guy. I could do 10. He's just an amazing guy. I love asking him questions and hearing his answers. He's just... I hope you're enjoying it. We will pick that up soon. In the meantime, I got to get to the beach. No kidding. I'm like late for the beach. It's terrific. I'm in Florida and I am needed at the beach. So to be continued, everyone, you can follow me on Twitter at GregKellyUSA, at GregKellyUSA. And of course, there's the Newsmax show Monday through Friday, 7 o'clock East Coast time. To be continued, everyone. And I will be talking with Eric again. We have at least another one or two parts left. So thank you and take care.